You are listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs in Washington, D.C. Okay, why don't we get started? It's good to see such a crowd here today. We are very fortunate to have with us this evening for our symposium Professor Uri Bar-Joseph. Uri's an associate professor in the Division of International Relations at the School of Political Science at the University of Haifa in Israel. He has his PhD from Stanford, my undergraduate alma mater, I believe in 1990. And in fact, I remember him from then, though I don't think he remembers me. As a junior, or I might have been a senior, I was allowed to take a graduate-level seminar in international relations, international relations theory, actually, and he was in that class as, I believe, a brand-new PhD student, and I just have a mental image of him sitting down at the far end of the table directly opposite the professor. In any event, he's a renowned scholar of intelligence. A revised version of his dissertation was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press under the title of Politics of Democratic States, the U.S. Intelligence Intervention in the Politics of Democratic States, the U.S., Israel, and Britain. It won a Choices Outstanding Academic Book Award for 1996. In 2010, he published in Israel a book called The Angel, about Egyptian President Nasser's son-in-law, a man named Ashraf Marwan, who was a spy for Israel, and we may hear more about him this evening, I'm not actually sure. But Dr. Bar-Joseph is probably best known, at least on in this country, for his work on surprise and intelligence failures. And probably his best-known work in this regard is The Watchman Fell Asleep, The Surprise of Yom Kippur and Its Sources. This book first came out in 2001, and won the Israeli Political Science Association Best Book Award the next year in 2002. And indeed, 40 years ago in 1 month, if I do my arithmetic correctly, Egyptian forces crossed the Suez Canal and attacked the Israeli Defense Forces occupying the Sinai at that time, inflicting a catastrophic defeat on them. And at the very same time, Syrian forces attacked the Israelis in the Golan Heights. It was a war 40 years ago that Israel came very, very close to losing, in large part because they were caught by surprise. So Dr. Bar-Joseph will speak with us this evening about that surprise and perhaps what the United States intelligence community might profitably learn from it and how we should think about intelligence failure and surprise. So without further ado, Uri Bar-Joseph.
Thank you very much. Good evening, and thank you for inviting me here, and special thanks for the subject, because it is quite rare for me, and I think that for scholars from other countries, not American scholars, to speak about lessons that the American intelligence community can draw from the experience of other nations, and believe me or not, it can. So what I'll try to show here is what I consider as the major lesson from the Israeli intelligence failure in 1973, in the war of 1973. Just to give you an illustration about the dimensions of this defeat during the first days of this war, during the first 24 hours of the war, the Israelis lost, the IDF, the Israeli army, lost 500 soldiers killed, which in proportion to the population of America, the United States, equals to something like 31,000 soldiers. And may I remind you that during the war in Vietnam, the United States lost altogether about 58,000 soldiers. So Israel lost more than half in proportion of the American losses in Vietnam during the first 24 hours of this war. Israel also lost something like 300 out of 500 tanks with which it started the war, and major losses in the air. Actually, 24 hours after the war started, Minister of Defense Dayan, who is shown here, the guy with the only one eye, started talking about the war as a fight for the third temple. And in the Israeli history, we lost already one temple and then the second. And talking about the third temple meant that from his perspective, the future of Israel as a state wasn't safe anymore. And all this took 24 hours from the beginning of the war to something like exactly, it started on October 6th, exactly 40 years and 1 month. Today, and until today, Israel did not recover from the shock of this war. It is still considered, and it is, the most traumatic event in Israel's history, and Israel is a very traumatic patient, I would put it, so it is not such a normal country, you know, many wars, many events, and this is the most traumatic, most dramatic one. What I'll try to explain here or claim, make the claim here is that Israel's problem was that it had too good intelligence, and this was the source of its failure when the war started. And now the common wisdom is that high quality intelligence means of collection measured in terms of accessibility and reliability will yield better decision-making process. Recent years' lessons from the 1973 War of Yom Kippur show that this is not necessarily the case. And now, in order to validate this claim, let me move on. Because I understand that there is some time pressure, everything is on the slides. So actually I can keep quiet from now on, but I'll nevertheless speak a little bit. A word about Israel's intelligence collection capabilities and responsibilities before the war. First of all, since August 1970, ceasefire existed between Israel and Egypt. So for more than 3 years before war started, no fire was exchanged between the Israelis and the Egyptians. Nevertheless, war warning ranked the highest in Israel's intelligence services order of priorities. Now, the responsibility within the Israeli intelligence community with regard to Arab states was divided between military intelligence, which in Israel is the most senior intelligence agency until today, and the Mossad, which is far more known, especially for its specialty operations. Now, military intelligence in Israel is in charge of collection from all sources other than human intelligence, that is spies. And in 1973, it had a sole responsibility for national intelligence analysis, which means that the director of military intelligence was the nation's prime intelligence analyst. The Mossad was in charge of UMINT, and we'll see that the UMINT was important, but it had no role in national analysis. A few words about Israel's means of collection. SIGINT, signal intelligence, through SIGINT, military intelligence, which was the sole responsibility of military intelligence, Israel had good coverage of the Egyptian and the Syrian military activity along the borders. It had also partial coverage of Arab foreign traffic, especially communication between Arab embassies and the foreign offices in the Arab states. Visual intelligence, Israel had an excellent coverage of the Syrian front from Mount Hermon, and a good coverage of the Suez front through local observation posts. Photography capabilities for deeper cover were used as well, but they were not perfect due to the fact that the Egyptian depth was covered or was defended by a massive surface-to-air missile defense. Human-to-human intelligence, the Mossad had a few excellent sources in Egypt, and I'll speak specifically about one of them who was mentioned already. Israel, also called the Israeli intelligence community, had traditionally cooperated with a number of foreign intelligence services such as the CIA, DIA, MI6, or SIS. And we also were assisted by Arab leaders, primarily King Hussein of Jordan, who shared the Israeli interest in avoiding a war, and therefore he provided Israel with early warning prior to the breakout of the war. And in addition to all that, open sources intelligence was also available, and Israeli, Arabic-speaking Israelis monitored 24 hours a day, Arab media, and received quite a few indications also from the Arab media about what's coming up. I would make only one point. All this means sufficed to give the Israeli decision makers about 34 hours before war started a sufficient, good enough intelligence picture to take to relate to the situation as meaning war. And nevertheless, the Israeli leaders avoided from taking the necessary means to meet the coming attack until something like 8 hours before war started. This was the reason for the catastrophe at the beginning of the war. And I would say that the reason for this delay is this. The fact that Israel had two jewels in the crown of its intelligence. One was Ashraf Marwan, known as the Angel. You heard about him just now. And the other, less known yet, which a SIGINT special means of collection, which I'll speak, and I'll speak about both these means of collections and I'll explain why, especially counting on the special means of collection, delayed the Israeli response to the war. But let me start with the spy, with Ashraf Marwan. And here is briefly his life story. He was born in 1944 in Cairo to a good family. In 1965, he completed his studies in chemistry and joined the army. And a year later, he married the president, the daughter of President Nasser, Mona. Here you see the daughter, the groom, and the President Nasser. And I don't know if you know enough about our world, about President Nasser, but Nasser was like a god then in the 1960s, and I think that until today he's considered as the most important Arab leader, at least since Salah ad-Din of about 1,000 years ago. That is, he's the most important Arab leader of many generations. So Ashraf Marwan married his daughter. In 1968, Marwan joined the Presidential Information Office under President Nasser. In September 1970, following the death of Nasser, he became a close aide of President Sadat. And in December 1970, he volunteered to the Mossad. He called the Mossad station in London and offered his services, and he was accepted. His code name was the Angel. Why he did that, I don't have time to speak about it now, but he had good reasons. What type of information Marwan gave the Israelis? And I remind you, he was a very close aide to Sadat. In fact, every information that Sadat, President Sadat, saw, Marwan could see as well. Okay, before that, what was How was Marwan treated by Israel's policymakers? Golda Meir, the prime minister at the time, and Moshe Dayan, the minister of defense, and the chief of staff, received his reports personally and routinely once every week or 2 weeks or so. They put great stock in the information. And in Israel, and for them, Marwan was the main source of information with regard to Sadat's strategy. If Egypt goes to war, we'll know about it first of all through the good services of Marwan. Not necessarily the timing of the war, if it will be October 6, October 7, or October 5, but that Egypt goes to war, we'll know about it from Marwan. What did it tell us about the war? Before Sadat decided, before Egypt decided to go to war on October 1972, in late October 1972, Marwan gave us, or provided us, the Israelis, with protocols of high-level internal discussions in Egypt and of Sadat's talk and correspondence with Secretary Brezhnev of the USSR and Prime Minister Kosygin, which showed that the Egyptian leadership estimated that no war could be launched without first neutralizing the Israeli Air Force. That is, until Egypt had ground-to-ground missiles, the Scud missiles, which Egypt got in summer 1973, and even more important than that, aircraft that could attack the Israeli bases and neutralize the Israeli Air Force bombing the bases, the Egyptians themselves estimated that they cannot go to war. Then, in October 1972, Sadat decided that he cannot wait for the aircraft or the missiles, and he decided to go to war. What type of information did Marwan give the Israelis about this decision? He gave the Israelis the minutes of the meetings in which Sadat ordered the army to prepare for imminent war. He also provided reports about military preparations and exercises for the coming war, reports on transfer of additional Soviet arms, including Scud-B missiles, ground-to-ground missiles, to Egypt in the summer of 1973. And he gave Israel the Egypt's two war plans, granite and high minerites. These are the plans, and if you look at the plans, you understand why it is so important. Granite plan shows, according to the arrows here, that the Egyptian army, this is the Suez Canal, here the Egyptians will cross the canal, and then with two tank divisions, they'll break into the Sinai in order to occupy the Sinai. This was the plan that was known to the Egyptian generals, to the Syrians, to everyone. But since Egypt could not go to war without neutralizing Israel's air superiority first, the Egyptian planner had made a plan B, if you want, and this was the actual war plan, and it was called High Minerites. The Egyptian army will cross the canal, advance something like 6 miles into the Sinai, and doesn't move anymore, so that it will be protected by air defense layout of some missiles here on the western side of the canal and be protected from the Israeli Air Force. Okay, this was the actual plan. The nice thing is that we, the Israelis, we got from Marwan the real Egyptian plan. The Syrians went to the war knowing that the Egyptians are going to do the granite war plan. So we knew better than the Syrians the Egyptian war plans. Now, Marwan, as I said before, Marwan gave us the Sadat strategy. He didn't have the means To communicate with the Mossad from Egypt. He didn't have a wire set, a radio. In fact, he got the radio, but he was afraid, so he threw it to the Nile and was left without a radio. He was accepted to provide a general war warning that Egypt plans to go to war. But as we will see in a minute, the Israeli army relied on an alternative source for an operational warning, not on Marwan. Finally, Marwan provided an unambiguous warning that war will break out tomorrow in a meeting that he held with the head of the Mossad, Tzvi Zamir, in London, only 14 hours before war started. As we know today, he learned that war will start tomorrow, that is, on October 6, only on the morning of October 5, and by incident, I won't get into these details. And we were lucky that he was abroad during these days, because had he been in Egypt, he wouldn't be able to provide any warning at all. And with this, we end the role of Marwan. I'll just say one more word. If it is, there is a consensus about most students of the war, that if Marwan did not provide this warning and the Israeli deployment for war, that is the mobilization of the reserve army and the deployment of the regular army, would have started only when war started, that is at 2 o'clock on October 6, Israel would have lost the Golan Heights completely during the first 24 hours of the war. And had the Syrian took over the Golan Heights during the first stage of the war would have looked very differently. So despite the fact that the warning came late, it was nevertheless very useful, not with regard to Egypt, but with regard to Syria. Now I come to the second jewel in the Israeli crown of intelligence collection. The special means of collection. Now, until today, the nature, what are these special means of collection, we don't know yet. It is an official secret. They are known as the special means of collection. I give you here a description of this means as given by Howard Bloom, an American author who wrote about the War of Yom Kippur. You can read what it is. I would say it is not necessarily 100% reliable. Okay, mildly put. But in essence, it gives you the capability of this means. Unit 848 in 1973 is the equivalent of the American NSA. It's our SIGINT unit. So these were means that could be operated from Israel and deliver very important talks from Egypt to the Israelis. Telephone talks, if you need to be a little bit more precise. Okay, can move on. Now, until a few years ago, we didn't know much about the relevance or how the way that Israel's top policymakers related to this, looked at these means and how they counted on these means when making the decision whether to prepare for war or not, to call the reserve army for or not. During the last 2-3 years, the testimonies of the Israeli policymakers were released. The testimonies in the Agranat Investigation Commission, which was nominated by the government, appointed by the government after the war in order to investigate what happened. Why was this intelligence failure and why were other failures took place? And today we have almost all the relevant testimonies. I say today because the last ones were released about less than a week ago on Thursday last week. And they are already here, so you are really updated. Let me start with the testimony of the Director of Military Intelligence, Major General Eli Zeira, who was the number one intelligence officer in Israel in 1973, whose word, I mean, he participated in all the meetings, and he was the one who, I mean, if he said no war, then you can hardly say it is a war. And he told the Agronat Commission that Amman's analysts estimated that Egypt could not launch war without having long-range attack planes and Scud missiles. I spoke about it earlier. And I, Eli Zeira, accepted the logic. The question that I asked myself was, where is my insurance in case they were wrong? My insurance was the special means of collection. And I said to myself, if the analysts are wrong, then I must receive through this means unambiguous indications that they are wrong. This was the essence of my thinking. So you can immediately see how critical how critical was the role of this special means of collection in the eyes of the Director of Military Intelligence. Let's see what the others said. Prime Minister Golda Meir said, it was absolutely clear that the special means of collection were operational and that through them there was a way to know about the incoming Arab attack. This, she says again in the in her testimony before the investigation committee. Then the Minister of Defense, Moshe Dayan. I accepted Amman's assumption that if Egypt launches war, we will have indications for that from the special means of collection. This was released only last week. Actually, the one by Zeira also was released only last week. Then the Chief of Staff. The Chief of Staff, I quote him from his words in a cabinet meeting about 26 hours before the outbreak of the war. Now, you have to understand, in this war, every hour counted, every minute counted. And 26 hours before the war, at about 12 o'clock on October 5, war started on 2 o'clock in the afternoon on October 6, the Chief of Staff said to a few ministers who asked him about it, we keep the mobilization of the reserve army and other acts till we receive other indications. In his testimony before the Agronat Commission, he was asked, what were the other indications? What other indications did you expect? And he said, I knew that we had excellent SIGINT, signal intelligence, he meant special means of collection. And I was certain that if these two armies, these two air forces, attack together, something will come out. If we listen to them, something will come out. He was certain that he will receive at least 48 hours warning prior to the outbreak of the war through this means. The Deputy Prime Minister, Yigal Alon, said about the same meeting in which the Chief of Staff said what he said, two things call me on the cabinet meeting of October 5. The unambiguous knowledge that we'll have sufficient warning for mobilization of the reserve army and a preemptive strike and the reinforcement of the regular army on the border. He counts again on the unambiguous knowledge that will have sufficient warning. We all know where he was, and he said that he expected this sufficient warning from the special means of collection. Lastly, the minister without portfolio and the prime minister's right-hand man, Israel Galili. Again, in his testimony after the war before the investigation committee, he said, "As I said earlier, I knew about our great achievements in the field of electronics." Now it is censored. Actually, much of what they say about this means is still censored. And, of course, he speaks about, when he says electronics, he speaks about the special means of collection. And he says, "They nurtured," this means nurtured, "our sense of confidence, especially since we got through this means more than once information of critical value." In fact, in May 1973, that is about 5 months before the war, there were warnings that Egypt plans to go to war. Egypt conducted a large-scale exercise which we knew that could be a disguise for war. Through this means, we learned that the exercise was a real exercise and not a preparation for war. Okay, so they proved already the reliability, and this is what he means when he says that through this means, we got more than once information of critical value. Undoubtedly, he continues, "This nurtured our confidence that we will have a war warning." Altogether, this group of five persons, the Prime Minister, Defense Minister, Chief of Staff, Deputy Prime Minister, and Mr. Galili, they are the decision-making group. They make the decisions. They are Golda Meir's kitchen cabinet. No one else participates in this in this decision-making process in national security affairs, and they all believed that the special means of collection would provide at least 48 hours, if not more than that, of warning before war started. So what happened? Why the special means did not provide a warning? Because we know that they didn't provide a warning. If they provided a warning, Israel wouldn't be caught unprepared for war. Now, amazingly as it may sound, throughout the week before the war, senior military intelligence officers, that is, it includes the director of his military intelligence collection department, the head of the SIGINT unit, the head of the analytical branch of military intelligence, all senior, very senior officers, they all urged Director of Military Intelligence, Zaira, to activate the special means of collection. He refused. He refused for two reasons. First, he estimated that there will be no war until the very last minute. The Director of Military Intelligence believed that the Arabs will not go to war without getting the aircraft first and the Scud missiles also. And second, he was worried about the safety of these means because their use could lead to the exposure and subsequent loss. And they were too critical to be used just in a case where you are certain that no war will take place. However, at the same time, when asked about it, Zaira told his superiors, Defense Minister Dayan and the Chief of Staff, that the means were operational and yielded no indications for war. As far as they know, the means are operational. They provide no indications for war. In other words, no war is coming. There is no war. And I know that, of course, you would like to know why he behaved the way he did. The Director of Military Intelligence, I wrote about it, an article together with a well-known psychologist. I can give you a reference to this article if you want later. But this is not the subject of our talk here, so we'll leave this maybe to the Q&A. What was the reaction after or during the war, after the war, the policymakers learned that the means had not been activated? What did they say about it? Some of them learned about it only when they testified on the subject before the Agronat Commission. The Agronat Commission members knew already that the means had not been activated, and they told these policymakers who were involved in the most delicate issues of Israel, they told them they didn't work the means. Did you know that the means didn't work? And here is their reaction. The chief of staff said, "I'm shocked. I knew the means capabilities, and if no war information came out of them, it was obvious that everything was all right. Now I understand that I wasn't told the truth." The Minister of Defense said, that's Dayan said, "I'm completely surprised." The Deputy Prime Minister said, "It's a terrible thing." And a minister without portfolio and Golda Meir's close aide said, "I'm not surprised, I'm shocked. Now I see that we have enough time." So this minister without portfolio, Galili, is known to have very good Hebrew. He knows the difference between surprise and shock. But to illustrate the difference between surprise and shock, let me tell you the Webster anecdote. Noah Webster, who wrote the famous dictionary, sat in his office one day, and at noon he didn't feel so well. So he decided to go back home, and he came home, and he found his wife at the hands of a lover. So his wife looked at him and she said, "Oh, I'm surprised." And he said, "I'm shocked." She was surprised because he came a little bit earlier. He was shocked because suddenly his whole worldview of his relationship with her was changed. This is the difference between surprise and shock. And here, Galili uses very nicely this distinction. So what are the main lessons from this story? First of all, policymakers, as well as intelligence makers, should not rely exclusively on a single means of warning, even when it seems infallible. Had we counted only on the observation, the reports of the observation posts along the canal, and no one paid attention to these reports because we had this wonderful means of collection and other means as well, but the reports along the reports of the observation posts along the canal, which saw the Egyptian army deploys for war, were sufficient to understand that Egypt goes to war. There was no other explanation, could be no other explanation to these preparations. Second lesson, do not rely on one agency and one intelligence maker, in this case, military intelligence and the director of military intelligence, when it comes to fateful decisions. Always take the advice or listen to another intelligence maker or a few of them. And finally, beware of senior intelligence officers with a high need for cognitive closure. High need for cognitive closure is characterizes the mind of people who find it very difficult to live in an ambiguous milieu or environment. They want everything to be either black or white. When it is gray, it is very difficult for them to live, to continue living. They feel inconvenient and other things as well. Zaira, the director of military intelligence, had an unbelievable need for cognitive closure. And this was the reason why he blocked himself to all the information that could that indicated that he might be wrong. Because if he is wrong and Egypt and Syria go to war, he enters into a gray area, and in a gray area he doesn't know how to behave. It is very inconvenient for him to be in the gray area. There are very simple tests to find out who has the personality of someone with a high need or a low need for cognitive closure. Intelligence people usually should have, everyone actually, should have something in the middle, not too high, not too low, need for cognitive closure. I can give you another lecture about cognitive closure, but this is not my topic. Suffice to say that probably when you enter the CIA today, they give you this type of test to see what type of person you are. But obviously, if you are nominated to become the director of CIA, you'll never have to go through this test. So I assume that people with high need for cognitive closure can become directors of CIA, but not analysts in the agency. Here I'll stop, and now the floor is yours.
Well, let's first have a round of applause and thank you for we've got plenty of time for questions, but I'm going to start with just a simple factual one. I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this question, but I'm curious. What happened to the director of military intelligence afterwards? Was he fired? Sounds like he should have been, and then we'll go to the audience.
He was fired, I mean, but the chief of staff was fired as well, and some other generals were fired as well. The problem was that the public knew that he did a very, very bad job, but only now we understand how bad it was.
Others here. Yeah,
yes, please.
So how has Israel adapted to this, like, since then? Do you have any specifics? Have they diversified branches? Or?
Yes. One of the main conclusions from the war was that we need two intelligence analytical units, not only one. So the Mossad developed its own analytical or research division, and it is a very strong division today. In addition, when there are critical, I mean, since 1973, Israel had never gone into a situation like this, but whenever there is important security, national security issues are on the table, both the director of the Mossad and the director of military intelligence, perhaps some other officers, participate in the discussion. So there is not only one, a single estimate by one person. Yes, please.
What were the diplomatic techniques used by the Arabs to deceive Israelis into thinking that war was not possible, if any?
Well, as we know today, Arabs... Okay, let me put it in a larger frame. The Israeli intelligence failure is usually compared to the American Pearl Harbor and to the Soviet failure in 1941 known as Barbarossa. Now, when you look at Pearl Harbor, I think that today we can say, despite what Roberta Wolstetter wrote in 1962 in a famous book, the Americans simply didn't have sufficient intelligence to show that the Japanese intend to attack Pearl Harbor. They knew that the Japanese are up to something, but Pearl Harbor was not considered as a possible target. So the main problem of the Americans was information. In the case of Barbarossa, there were two problems. First of all, quite a sophisticated German deception plan. That aimed at convincing the Soviets that Germany will not attack in 1941 but in 1942. But more important than that was the personality and the ruling style of Stalin, which prevented anyone from opening and telling his honest opinion with regard to the German intentions, and Stalin did not want a German attack in 1941 because the Soviet army wasn't ready, so no one could tell him, Comrade Stalin, you are wrong. I mean, you could tell him, but then, you know, next day you will not be around. So these were the main reasons for the intelligence failures in these two cases. The Soviet had excellent information about Barbarossa, coming Barbarossa. In the Israeli case, we had excellent information about everything. The Arab deception plans was mediocre at best, I would say a little bit primitive. Today we know that, in fact, again, from an official testimony of the head of the collection department in military intelligence that was released last week, he says something like, many Egyptian officers knew that war is coming during the last week before it came, but we didn't pick it up because of obvious reasons. They disguised the preparations for war in an exercise, but it was the special means of collections aimed at making distinction between an exercise and war. And of course, in Israel, we didn't have a Stalin type authoritarian type of government or whatever. So we had everything in our hand to avoid this because deception wasn't crucial, and yet the problem was this and not the Arab deception. Oh. My 40 minutes are over.
You.
What type of intelligence warning was Israel receiving from allied nations? And the second question is, did analysts explain away all the other indications of warning as it's coming out?
About the first question. Our main ally is, as you may know, the United States. A week before war started, the CIA warned Israel on the basis of information that the CIA got from King Hussein of Jordan that the Arabs are going to war. The Israelis convinced the CIA and the United States that the Arabs are not going to war. So towards Friday and Saturday, towards October 5 and 6, the CIA accepted that no war is on the horizon, because if the Israelis are not worried about war, why should the Americans be worried about war? Okay? Makes sense. And they had a lot of appreciation to the Israeli intelligence collection and analysis of what happens in Egypt and Syria. What was the second question?
The analysts in Israel explain away all the...
Again, it is a very complicated story, but the chief analyst of Egyptian affairs, who was the most critical intelligence analyst, he was very similar in his pattern of behavior to Zaira. He also believed for more than a year that the Egyptians will not go to war. And we have a report, intelligence report, about 24 hours before war started. In 38 sections, it describes all the indications for war. The Egyptian army is fully deployed for war. The Syrian army is fully deployed for war. They changed frequencies. They did this. They moved we know the preparation plan, so they moved all the airplanes that are supposed to take part in the war. They moved them to forward air bases. They took other airplanes to bases. They did everything. I mean, everything means war. The Soviets started on October 4th an emergency evacuation of families and experts from Egypt and Syria, and we know about it. We follow it in real time. We listen to Soviet families in Syria, and they talk about the need to get in 20 minutes to the airport or 30 minutes to the airport with 30 kilos of luggage. That's it. Emergency. And the bottom line, of the report says something like, despite the fact that all this information may indicate war, there is no change in our estimate that Egypt does not perceive itself as capable of going to war with Israel, and therefore war is unlikely. That's about it.
In looking at this as lessons from defensive position, how do you think these are all applied, these lessons, looking at more of an offensive war in Lebanon?
Well, I think that there is a major difference between intelligence that you prepare or you work on for your own operations and intelligence that is supposed to provide you a warning before the enemy attacks you. We know that the Israelis are quite good at collecting operational intelligence. We see it even in Iran here and there. We saw it in Lebanon. During the first day of the war in Lebanon in 2006, in 2006 or 7, I don't remember, the Israeli Air Force knocked out all the heavy rockets of Hezbollah, which Hezbollah had everywhere, in houses, in gardens, everywhere. They knocked them out, all of them. So the Hezbollah couldn't launch rockets against Tel Aviv or big targets, long-range rockets. You can count on the Israeli intelligence to provide excellent operational intelligence. But of course, when it comes to assessing what happens in the Middle East, such as the Arab Spring, well, 2 weeks before the Egyptian president Mubarak lost his position, the director of military intelligence said that we don't see any sign that Mubarak is going to fall soon. So in this case, we are together with the American, wrong as always.
On that cheery note, we've got time for one more question. Another must be one. Yeah, right here.
My question is about Marwan. What evidence do you have that Marwan was not working as a double agent?
Well, only one. All the information that he provided. Because if he was a double agent, why should he tell? I mean, we know that everything that he told us was true because during the last 40 years, the Egyptians wrote their memoirs and their histories, and we know what he reported about what happens in Egypt or what was happening in Egypt, and we know now what really happened in Egypt. Everything was right. And then, if he was a double agent, why should he warn Israel about the incoming war? If you want to be a double agent, tell the Israelis, oh, we are so worried that you are going to attack us or something like this. Please don't attack us. I mean, we are very nervous. He didn't do it. He just said, we are going to attack you.
Well, Professor Bar-Joseph has given us much to think about this evening, so let's thank him again for one of
the Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University. For information about our part-time graduate programs, go online to advanced.jhu.edu. We hope you'll join us next time.